Periodically, there's a scary outbreak of mad cow disease, and recently, chronic wasting disease has been spreading among herds of elk and deer and moose in the West and Midwest. Both of these infectious diseases are caused by prions, which are proteins present in all of us. Much is still unknown about prions, and here to explain how they work and what we have learned so far are Walker Jackson, postdoctoral associate in the Lindquist Laboratory at MIT's Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research, and Dr. David Westaway, professor of neurology and director of the Center for Prions and Protein Folding Diseases at the University of Alberta. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show, and I invite our listeners to join the conversation later. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. David, so what do we know about prions?
Well, good morning. We know quite a bit about them now. At one stage, they were rather mysterious infectious diseases that affected the brain, and it was sort of known in veterinary medicine after the Second World War that there were some diseases that looked like they were going to be a bit strange. And then the pace of the story picked up in the 1970s and 1980s, and at that stage it became clear that these were quite unusual infectious diseases that weren't caused by the usual suspects, and the usual suspects would be bacteria and viruses. And in fact, these diseases are caused by a misfolded form of a protein that we all have, we all make in the day-to-day activity of our body. We make this normal protein called the cellular prion protein, and then this component of our cells can be sort of sent astray when it gets into the wrong shape, and at that stage it will cause damage to brain cells.
What do they do in their normal activities?
Well, that's been a long-standing mystery. I think that's becoming clearer as well. They help to protect brain cells from damage, and the very recent work has implied that they originally evolved. One of the ways they do this is to be able to deal with how cells take up trace elements, so things like metals. Metals are part of our diet, and our cells need metals. And one of the things that prion proteins do is to help metals like copper and zinc get into cells.
Do scientists know what causes prions to misfold and become infectious?
Yes, they know that proteins are a component of our cells. There's five classes of molecules that make up our cells, and proteins are sort of the action molecules, and they carry out a number of functions in our cells, and their function depends on their three-dimensional shape. They have very intricate three-dimensional shapes, and when a person or an animal gets infected with a prion disease, that the shape of the prion protein molecule changes. So they know with a fair amount of precision that the shape of the molecule changes. These days, scientists are interested in going into greater and greater amounts of precision to know where literally every single atom in the molecule is. We don't quite know that yet, but we're getting a little closer to that.
Now, Walker, David said that the disease looks strange. What are the trademarks of prion diseases?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, in that the diseases can be very different. Even within humans, there are several different kinds of prion diseases. And, for example, I study a disease called fatal familial insomnia. And in that disease, people usually present with inability to go to sleep or to sleep for normal amounts of time. And then it progresses to where their the autonomic nervous system, which controls things like body temperature and heart rate, that starts to fail, and eventually they die.
Is this transmitted the same way that Creutzfeldt-Jakob, or is it Jakob disease, is transmitted?
Actually, with fatal familial insomnia, it's caused by a mutation to the same gene, the prion protein gene. So it's not actually acquired from the diet as you would get with a person infected with mad cow disease material.
So this is a genetic, there's a genetic connection here?
Yes, it is. That sort of makes prion disease a really kind of a weird disease.
Are there prions diseases are only occur in mammals. Is that true?
As far as we know.
So are these sorts of things happening in other mammals as well?
Genetic prion diseases?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there was a case of mad cow disease in Alabama about 4 or 5 years ago. And it turns out that that cow had a mutation that would cause CJD in humans. CJD is a Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So, yes, it can happen in cattle. We've seen it at least once. And it could happen in other animals as well.
David, when did scientists link misfolded prions with these diseases?
Well, this happened in the mid-1980s. I mean,
fairly recently.
Yes, it was known that they were going to be unusual, and people suspected their mechanism, the way they worked, was going to be unusual, but it's comparatively recent. And the realization that these diseases are really to do with the particular shape of just one particular molecule, that happened in the mid to late 1980s.
How do they spread in the brain? Do they multiply, or do they infect healthy cells?
Yes, they do. They do both. They multiply in a rather funny sort of way, where if you get one protein in the wrong shape, it can come along and instruct a healthy protein that's in the right shape. It can sort of flip it over to the other bad shape that's associated with disease. So this is a process that people call templated misfolding. So the actual number of badly folded proteins in the brain can slowly build up by a sort of domino effect. And then we now know some facts about what we call the cell biology, of what the normal prion protein does within cells. And it turns out, maybe unfortunately, the normal prion protein within cells has a few tricks up its sleeve, where it is sitting on the top, on the surface of a cell, but it can go inside. It can break off from one cell and go towards another cell. It even has a signal in the front of the molecule where it can sort of burrow into another cell. So in a sense, rather unfortunately, it already has some propensity to go wandering from cell to cell. And of course, if the protein is a wrong shape, then it can sort of spread the mayhem from one infected cell, but it can start spreading to its neighbors that were still originally healthy.
Well, isn't this similar to what happens with viruses?
It's partly similar. So the viruses replicate, so there is a replicative cycle for prions, but viruses, their information for making a new virus lies within their own little part of the genetic code. So within their viral genome, which may be made of a DNA molecule or an RNA molecule, prions are quite novel in the fact no one has ever been able to show that the bad shape of the prion protein is encoded in what we call a genome. If the virus has a genome, you can go after it with certain you can sort of attack that part of the cycle of the virus, but prions don't have a genome. So in some ways they have some similarities, but they have a major divergence in the fact they don't have a genome that incorporates extra components. So a virus is sort of from outside the animal it's replicating in. It's sort of a foreign molecule. In the case of a prion disease, the relationship is a bit more subtle, where we have a sort of normal molecule that's present within the animal, and that just one molecule changes shape. So they're sort of blended into the host a bit better, and for that reason they sort of evade some of the normal defense processes that would be used to ferret out an invading foreign particle.
My guests are Dr. David Westaway, professor of neurology and director of the Center for Prions and Protein Folding Diseases at the University of Alberta in Canada, and Walker Jackson, postdoctoral associate in the Lindquist Laboratory at MIT's Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When the first cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease appeared in young people in 1996, did scientists know right away that they were infected by eating beef with mad cow disease?
Well, yes, they had a very strong suspicion. So this was what is called variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So when the people got sick, their symptoms of disease were a little bit different from the classical Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease that had been known previously. All the people, these 10 cases that appeared, they were all in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom had hundreds of thousands of animals that were sick with mad cow disease with BSE, so it was an educated guess, but it was the obvious inference to make given that background information.
Walker, was the prion disease's ability to spread from one species to another a surprise?
I think so. There was another prion disease that's been known for at least 100 years called scrapie, and it affects sheep and goats, and humans have been pretty much just living with scrapie for a long time and even eating the meat. And apparently no humans have ever come down with scrapie disease. So I think it was a bit of a surprise that this disease in cattle could transfer to humans.
There's also another human disease called kuru. How is it contracted?
So that's an interesting disease in itself, and it's contracted by human cannibalism, where unfortunately the brains of deceased family members are consumed by the survivors, and they eventually will develop the same disease that killed the original person.
But is that a variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
It's a disease. It's clinically it looks different from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, but it still is a prion disease in that it still involves the same protein. And the brain shows very similar changes to it. It's just different parts of the brain are affected.
Now, since they attack the brain, and I throw this out to both of you, are there links between prion diseases and Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases?
Yes, this is David Westaway speaking here. There have been some tantalizing links for a number of years. I mean, it is known that other neurodegenerative diseases share the central theme of some proteins ending up in the wrong shape. In prion diseases other than prion disease, it turns out to be different protein molecules that end up in the wrong shape, but that theme was known. So, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, there's a small part of a protein that goes under the name amyloid beta that ends up in the wrong shape. The way that molecule is made in the first place is a little different from prion disease, and there are certain mutations that can give you Alzheimer's disease that have to do with the way about making that molecule in the first place. But there are some intriguing overlaps. Some of for example, that when you make the small molecule of Alzheimer's disease, it depends on a chopping protein, and there's been some interest in that chopping protein. Called BACE, is somehow can be involved in processing the prion protein. And earlier in this year, in March, there was a very impressive, I think almost a breakthrough, published by scientists working in Yale, where they believe that the cellular prion protein, the normal prion protein we have, may unfortunately, transduce or convert the bad protein of Alzheimer's disease. It may convert a signal from that protein such that the brain cells in Alzheimer's disease are damaged. So that was really quite an impressive convergence between two fields that were sort of running in parallel with some hints, but I think now we're beginning to realize that those fields are closer than we previously suspected.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. David Westaway, Professor of Neurology and Director of the Center for Prions and Protein Folding Diseases at the University of Alberta, and Walker Jackson, postdoctoral associate in the Lindquist Laboratory at MIT's Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research. Our number again, 212-433-9692. ¶¶ we're talking about prions on today's Please Explain segment with Dr. David Westaway of the University of Alberta and Walker Jackson of MIT. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692 online at WNYC. Or you can write to us, on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go to our first caller, Matt from Greenpoint. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard.
Yes, Matt.
I was wondering if I had a question about Alzheimer's and specifically if you guys has any insight into any kind of causal relationship in the statistical overlap between Alzheimer's patients and diabetes patients that I've read about.
Do either of you want to tackle that? David?
Well, there are some... I think there's a small sort of epidemiological overlap. The main cause of typical Alzheimer's disease, or the main risk factor, just turns out to be how old you are. There are, if one comes down to the level of chemists, there are some type 2 diabetes, there is a molecule that goes wrong. We also know that that changes shape and aggregates. That's a molecule called IAPP. It may be as we go further forward, we find out that there's sort of more overlap in the chemistry of the IAPP molecule and the prion protein molecule. But there's no very, very strong causal connection known at this time.
We thank you for your call. We go now to Bruce from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. A friend of mine's kid, several years ago, died because he got a bug bite and he got encephalitis, in his brain and up in Westchester County. So what causes, bovine spongiform encephalitis? He got this disease from a tick bite or whatever. How is it related?
Is there any connection between the fact that both of those things have the phrase encephal in them?
Yes. One is an encephalitis and one is encephalopathy. So unfortunately, the jargon is formidable. It doesn't really help. So they are a little bit different in their fundamental mechanism. So one is to do with the unfortunate consequences of an inflammatory response in the brain from the bug bite, but encephalopathy really refers to sort of a general attack on the brain material, and these prion diseases are also called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, and one of their most famous features, as it were, is that they're not rapid, that they evolve in animals, they evolve over months to years, often with a time span of years. In humans, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease might involve a time from first diagnosis to death of 6 months. So they're sort of slow, unstoppable diseases, and they're not quite as acute as having an encephalitis, an inflammatory response in the brain.
How do cows become infected with bovine spongiform encephalopathy?
Well, there were a lot of cows in Europe, and most of those were in the United Kingdom. So they got Walker mentioned a few moments ago about ritualistic cannibalism happening in New Guinea in the context of Kuru disease. The cows got infected by something that's now been called industrial cannibalism. I mean, cows are not normally walking around eating protein extracts from other cows, but as a sort of maybe an unfortunate trend in agricultural practice in the UK in the late 70s, the cows were fed these diets that were in part protein-enriched diets, in part derived by rendering, that is reprocessing from the bodies of slaughtered animals. And what must have happened was there was a prion protein in the animals that they were killing to make the protein supplement, the feed supplement, And then once the cows got given that in their feed rations, it made its way through their digestive system. It got out across the wall of their digestive system and then started a journey through their body and eventually ending up in their brain.
Well, Walker, cows are vegetarians normally, and here they are eating animal protein. So this does not occur naturally in cows. This is something that we have to give to them?
Well, I think at least one time it happened naturally in cattle, because it's sort of the chicken and the egg argument. There was at least one cow that had it from some other route. And that other route could have been that cow had a mutation to its prion protein gene, or it just happened spontaneously, which is something we don't really talk about much in the prion field, but just some kind of spontaneous conversion of the prion protein from its normal form to the disease-causing form.
Because the animal tissue that you're consuming doesn't necessarily have to be infected with a prion disease. Isn't that true?
Well, to transmit the disease, the tissue that you're feeding to your cow would have to have some infection going on.
Oh, okay.
It may be hard to detect, but it would be present.
Have there ever been outbreaks in Canada or in the United States?
You're asking about mad cow?
Yes.
Well, there's been some animals spotted. Yeah. I mean, the level of surveillance hasn't been as high as in Europe. Probably the level of occurrence is lower, but no, there have been cases of mad cow disease. That's what we now call classical BSC. They've been seen in the United States and in Canada.
Where does the term spongiform come from? What does the brain of an infected animal look like?
Well, it looks spongy. If you take when an animal dies, you can make a thin slice of the brain, like with a razor blade, and then you put it under a regular microscope, just like a microscope you'd have in any high school science lab. And then when you look down the microscope, it looks spongy. There are gaps in the brain where there shouldn't be, and that's the origin of the name spongiform.
Let's take another call. Jim from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My father died of CJD several years ago, and I am not allowed to give blood. I'm wondering what the connection is.
Well, the CJD, it comes in different forms. Walker mentioned previously that there can actually be forms of prion disease where there can be the prion disease can start in different ways. That's one of its unusual features. So you can start the disease by acquiring infection. Occasionally, very rarely, the disease starts because people have a mutation in their prion gene, and that mutation can be inherited.
Now, it was never determined whether it was inherited or it was something that he picked up by eating something or something along those lines.
A big one. They never determined it?
No, that was not something they never were able to tell us.
Well, I think it's sort of out of an abundance of caution that you may be forbidden to donate blood. I mean, I'm obviously British, so I was in and out of Britain during the 1980s, so just in case I somehow got exposed to BSC, I'm not allowed to donate the blood later. But
they do. Another caller also wants to know about this. She says she wonders why blood banks are interested in whether you've been exposed to CJD or mad cow.
Well, there is a...
Go ahead, Walker.
There is a little bit of epidemiological data that suggests that prion disease may have spread between humans through blood transmission. Because these diseases are very rare, it's hard to get very powerful statistical data to prove this case. But at least the possibility exists, and prions can exist in experimentally infected animals. So there is, a possibility of transmission there.
So but there's also a suggestion that that from these two calls that there's a genetic component to this. Do we really see that, or do we know enough about this illness to even know whether there's a genetic component?
Well, Well, yes, there are genetic forms of prion disease that in people are due to mutations in their prion protein gene, which is on chromosome 20. So those are quite well defined, delineated, and one can do genetic testing for them. I suppose the good news is that these mutations are very rare. So the most famous example of a genetic prion disease is a disease called Gerstmann-Streusler-Schenker syndrome, and it's a very interesting disease, but thankfully it has the sort of bonus of only being present in populations about 1 per 10 million level. So they're interesting, but thankfully exceedingly rare.
Can't the scientists who identify these diseases have easier to pronounce names?
Yes. Well, a lot of these names came from the turn of the century, that the German neurologists and neuropathologists were being very methodical in defining these diseases and looking at the brain tissue, and that's where these names. So they sort of come from the elder statesmen in the field of neurology.
Eric from New York City, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Incredible program. My question relates to the fact that you just alluded that there is potential for hematogenous spread of prions. So consequently, have prions been studied in other diseases for other organs, such as cardiovascular diseases, gastrointestinal diseases? And secondly, related to this, is it conceivable that the prions themselves can undergo conformational change so that, in fact, they are at some point not infectious, if quote-unquote, and then convert to an infectious form in relative exposure to other proteins or environmental changes?
Okay, well, there's two questions here. Maybe I can take a shot at the second one. So that's an interesting idea, is that can prions change to other shapes? So maybe I think what you're asking is can the appearance of disease seem different or even not be present? And there are some examples of what is called subclinical disease, where prions are sort of quiescent. They can sometimes go into an animal where they can't replicate very well, but they don't go away. And then if you take the tissue where they were sitting quiescently and then put it into another animal, the disease can reemerge. Whether they can cause other types of sort of new diseases, if we think outside of just considering the brain as a target for prions, it's early days. It hasn't been looked at a lot. We know in some instances the prion protein that changes shape can change shape in muscle tissue. So the type of, if you look down the microscope, tissue is different, so the types of changes it undergoes are rather different. But so that is known about, and there is there's a sort of rarer version of mad cow disease called BACE, where the prion protein is sitting in the muscle tissue, and there are some preliminary findings that that the animals that get that disease, actually the muscle, in other words, the meat, would be infectious if it was passed into another animal.
Walker, so, do you want to tackle any other part of that question?
I think David covered it pretty well.
Okay, thank you so much for calling us, Eric. And we go now to Barbara from New Jersey. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, hello. My question is concerned with a transmission of mad cow from cow to people. And my understanding is that prion is a misfolded protein. My understanding is that heat changes protein. And so I'm wondering why it is that cooking meat from a cow does not destroy the prion and prevent transmission.
Walker?
So it looks like the toxic element of prions is sort of actually a clump of these proteins. So it's just sort of a stack, maybe like a stack of paper cups or something. And once you have a clump of these proteins, it's very hard to denature them. That's what would happen with heat to a normal protein. It would sort of unfold. But while they're in these clumps, they're very hard to unfold. And that's true with a lot of other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. The proteins that clump in Alzheimer's are also hard to denature. with heat.
So cooking them isn't going to do the same kind of thing to them that cooking does to bacteria and, in some cases, viruses.
Exactly.
Now, I'm wondering about something where there would be no cooking, but I mentioned earlier there's been a spread of chronic wasting disease among all sorts of herds this year. Has this been a problem for a while now? David?
So this chronic wasting disease, it was started, I guess it was cited in the late 60s, and then people getting a little bit more focused on it in the 1970s. So it's been around for a few decades now.
But elk and moose don't eat animal protein.
No. That is a good point. So one area of interest or concern in it is to do with how prion diseases exist in natural settings in wildlife. It was known from this disease, scrapie, that there's a prion disease of sheep, that the disease could somehow spread laterally from one sheep to another. And that tendency is present really more strongly for chronic wasting disease that has its ability, as it were, to go sideways from one animal to another.
We've run out of time, but I wonder about eating venison. Could that be a problem? A very quick answer.
Well, if in doubt, leave it out. So the CWD doesn't seem to go into humans, but I guess if you have the option not to eat venison, then you could decline.
And we thank you both so much for being with us on today's Please Explain. Dr. David Westaway of the University of Alberta and Walker Jackson of MIT. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Okay, thank you very much, Leonard.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, guest host Julie Burstein speaks with neurosurgeon Dr. Sanjay Gupta about some of the more incredible medical advances that are allowing more patients to survive who once would have died. And then Judy Shepherd explains why she chose to be a gay rights activist after her son Matthew's death. Also, actress Alicia Silverstone fills us in on her life beyond Clueless and why she became a vegan. Plus, Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter David Finkel, who went to Baghdad with a bunch of Army infantry soldiers and chronicled how they changed over 15 months. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blake D. Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Adam Delahanty, Drew Katchen, and Ida Sadakiani. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Thanks for listening, and have a super weekend.